Good evening. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. It's May 19th, 2011, and welcome to the Soleri Report. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Before we start, a minute on housekeeping. I just want to remind you that Darlene Heckman runs our customer service. You can reach her at 888-755-3548. You'll find that number when you log into the cart. If you're having any trouble with email updates, you need help navigating the cart or learning about the service, please let Darlene know. We're very committed to you having an excellent experience. And so if anything's not working, please let Darlene know how she can help you. Again, 888-755-3548. You can find that number at your Soleri Report cart. Tonight, Jim Norman on oil car geopolitics. This is the third time I've had Jim Norman on the Soleri Report. Nobody's ever been on the Soleri Report more than three times other than Franklin Sanders. I keep being asked, where is my list of the top books for the 21st century? And I really am working on it. But one of the books that will absolutely be on that list is The Oil Card. I put a review of it up in I think, early 2010. I had taken it with me on a business trip, and I went down to the restaurant to have dinner by myself, and I just took The Oil Card with me, and I started to read it and literally couldn't put it down. I closed down the restaurant. I was the last one out, having finished The Oil Card over many cups of I don't remember if it was coffee or tea, but it's one of those books. You never view the world the same. Every time I turn around, I just see Jim's view of how things are playing out and why they're playing out. And I just thought there was no one, particularly after our interview with Lawrence Wilkerson, I thought there was no one better to help us sort of navigate through world events rather than Jim, no one better than Jim Norman. So I'm delighted he's back with us this evening. Our theme tonight is double binds everywhere you turn. Roosevelt once said about the oil companies, he said, you can't get elected without the oil companies, but you can't govern with them. And everywhere you turn, it's a little bit like that. The process, whether in Washington or globally, is being overrun with people who have sufficient power, including weaponry and covert power, to allow them to exercise control in a manner that makes things increasingly ungovernable. So the process is being run or controlled by, the people who can engineer as, indictments as we've watched in New York. And it means increasingly the process is decided in a variety of mannerisms that have nothing to do with sort of optimizing the whole. And so we see greater and greater unease in the financial markets about what could happen, because liquidity and leverage both depend on a widespread commitment to basic rule of law. And when that breaks down, you get real problems. The squabbling and the ridiculousness of the public reasons given for a variety of different recent squabbles, whether it was Trump and the birth certificate, or now the incidents with Strauss-Kahn and the IMF, these things just create a lack of confidence, which can become a much greater problem than the fundamental economics. Now, the story of the week in the financial markets, in my opinion, is the rise of the dollar on the fall of the head of the IMF, and I think those two things are very connected. Strauss-Kahn, the head of the IMF, was arrested in New York. The charge is alleged rape of a maid in his hotel. Remarkably, his deputy, now in charge as a J.P. Morgan Chase American banker, takes over. Immediately, as I describe in the blog, a $2.3 billion drawdown occurs on the Irish loan. The Greek and European debt workouts are lose an important player. Speculation takes off regarding what he did to offend. And the list is the possible list is many, from his criticism of the American banks and the financial crisis. I'm going to have the interview that he did in Charlie Ferguson's documentary Inside Job put up in the blog so you can watch it. It includes a story of the U.S. Secretary of Treasury, Hank Paulson, former chairman of Goldman Sachs and the heads of the banks. But he's been remarkably forthright about the expense to the to the emerging markets and the global economy of this kind of financial fraud. He's also, and I should mention, speaking of Goldman Sachs, they're probably pretty relieved that everybody's worried about Strauss-Kahn, because they were having a pretty bad week, what with a number of mortgage investigations underway, that some of which involve them, Rolling Stone continuing to breathe down their neck, and they were about to take a lot more bad headlines about their role of derivative swaps in Greece as the Greek workout was coming to a head, in which Strauss-Kahn had had some influence. Finally, we see Strauss-Kahn pushing for a global currency, another thing he could have done to offend. And according to Stiglitz, he was increasingly rejecting the neoliberal economics that the IMF is famous for, what Naomi Klein would call disaster capitalism, I would call tapeworm economics. If you go back and you read Klein's incredible book, Shock Doctrine, or watch her video done with her husband called The Take of the sort of the harvesting of Argentina, or Greg Palast's incredible reports in the early 2000s of sort of the IMF and World Bank role in Latin America, or read Ann Williamson on the rape of Russia, or you can read my blog post, Financial Coup d'Etat. The IMF has been really an integral part of harvesting places. And so any softening of that view would have an important impact, particularly as we see the first world trying to sort of harvest natural resources and continue the subsidy flow from the emerging markets. Now, as to the specific charges of whether or not he raped a maid in his hotel, there are three possibilities. He could be guilty, he could be innocent, or he could be framed, including with drugs, and whether technically he's guilty in that case can get pretty murky. Any one of the three is entirely possible. It's extremely hard for many citizens globally to believe that somebody could be entirely innocent and yet this could all be happening. But I assure you that is in fact the case. When they decide to turn the machinery on someone, as we've seen in the movie Enemy of the State, it's quite remarkable how they can turn, you know, day into night and the sun into the moon and yes into no, and it's really quite remarkable. So it's impossible at this point to tell what the truth is. The goal was clearly to get him out of the IMF and possibly the French election. It was expected he would run for the French presidency in 2012 and was sort of an early front runner. But whatever that goal was, presumably out of the IMF, it's been accomplished. So the remaining events related to his legal situation are simply a long drawn out mop of a situation that is politically entertaining but no longer politically relevant. Interestingly enough, one of the American names circulated for the new head is David Lipton, who was part of the privatization team, both the academic private team beforehand and then the U.S. Treasury team during the Clinton, that Williamson describes in The Rape of Russia, presumably someone who will be good at extracting subsidy and natural resources from those who are engineered into dependency on international institutions. It can be expected that the Europeans are going to want to name that position, and one of the front runners is the French Prime Minister, who's a finance minister, who's also someone who was highlighted in Charlie Ferguson's Inside Job. Whatever Strauss-Kahn did to offend, the spectacle that we're all watching now is having an unbelievably chilling effect on every business, financial, and government leader. What they all know is that if they don't do exactly what they're told, this could happen to them. And that they will not be protected from their foibles unless they play ball, or they can be set up and framed or falsely accused, whichever the case is. But it is an incredible reminder of how little power people in the machinery have. If you don't do what the machinery wants you to do, this is what can happen. And even if you do what the machinery wants to do, when different factions are fighting, you can just be a pawn. Somebody wants to take out the other queen, and so first they've got to take out, you know, you're the pawn and you get taken out. It was remarkable to see his ability. I mean, this guy clearly is pretty savvy, because a lot was done to cause him to lose his temper in front of the cameras, and he's done a remarkable job of keeping his cool. When they brought him in for the arraignment on the arrest, you could tell the reporters had been tipped off to where he would be, and the detectives did very little to shield him from the cameras. And as they walked in the building, you could hear them calling him Frenchie, which is clearly designed to get him to lose his temper. His coat had been pulled to the side, making him look disheveled. It wouldn't surprise me if one of the detectives did that. So the fact that he hasn't lost his cool is a compliment, because it's extremely difficult not to do it in that circumstance. Bottom line, I think this is all part of engineering what had to be done to keep the dollar floating up, which it continues to do. It we're sort of seesawing between 75 and 76 right now on the U.S. dollar index, and so, but it'll give you a sense of how fragile and delicate that game is. I continue to be very concerned about what's happening in Japan and Fukushima, but I have little to say about it. I'm doing the Jeff Rentz show next Wednesday night. Jeff has been following this very, very carefully and is extremely concerned about the impact on the Pacific Ocean, both the water quality and sea life of the radiation. Just because it's dropped off the first page, please don't assume we're out of the woods yet. The long-term impact, I think, of both Fukushima and the Gulf oil spill are not yet widely understood, and it's something I continue to keep a watch on and continue to be worried could jump out and bite us in terms of the performance of the stock market and the economy. Economic indicators all point to a slower economy, point to a slower economy. Coming into the summer months, that's not good, because you're getting a slower economy coming at a time when things usually slow down for many industries. The southern states continue to be hit unbelievably hard now with the Mississippi flooding. This morning, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had opened the 17th of 125 bays on the Morganza Spillway. And that means just continual flooding of farming and rural communities throughout Mississippi. We see corporations lining up lots of cash with bond issuance, including a huge new offering by Google. They're worried about higher interest rates or liquidity, or in my book, probably both. That's what I'd be worried about if I was a chief financial officer. Interest rates are at unprecedented lows. If you haven't refinanced your mortgage, Lord knows now's a good time to do it. It's hard to imagine they could drop any more. Bernanke says he's going to keep interest rates low, but a lot of people are concerned that they're rising. I continue to think that a lot can be done to keep interest rate lows, but it's going to mean more force, more violence, you know, more troubled times. Congress continues to squabble over the debt limit. It's painful to watch, and it underscores the challenges of trying to craft solutions within a wide group of constituencies who, by law or culture, refuse to accept responsibility for the whole. Now, that would be the case if we had to balance the budget, let alone do it in a manner that optimized national or international equity. And, of course, that's the system we need to get to, but we're far, far away from it there. When we talked with Colonel Wilkerson, we talked about the two scenarios of scramble versus blueprint, and every sign so far as we're watching seems to say we're going to scramble right now. The big question in the financial market is, will the Fed proceed with an overt QE3 that is another round of quantitative easing? Somebody said to me this week, what's QE3? And QE3 refers to the possibility of another round of quantitative easing. QE is acronym for quantitative easing, not the Queen Elizabeth. So it's a monetary boat, not a ship in the sea. Whether or not we get a QE3, I've said there's a covert QE3. Put that aside. Whether or not we get an overt QE3 could have a very major impact on whether commodities and equity markets go this fall. We've seen the dollar, as I said, run up. We have a rush of money coming out of commodities, including precious metals. I spent the week sort of fighting off a subscriber and client who's in a state of occasional panic. It's kind of 2 weeks after I stopped fighting off overconfidence. Sometimes it gets very frustrating to see the emotional swings that occur with these interim pump and dump in our switch from paper to tangibles. There's a marvelous piece by Stacey Herbert, the financial analyst who's such an important part of the Max Keiser show. I'm a great Stacey Herbert fan. And anyway, I put her piece up about this on the blog today, and I just wanted to read you a quote from it. She said, there are some that since 2001 have doubted the bull market in precious metals. In these past 6 weeks, however, everyone from former silver bulls to those who sell freeze-dried chicken, SH blank T, for a living are out shrieking the bears on the shriek factor. Do a Google search and you will find hundreds upon hundreds of references to Hunt Brother days, bubble, Hunt Brothers, sucker, bubble, 1980, bubble, lose money, bubble. Sure enough, it sounds exactly like the kind of things that have been sort of pushed to put people in a panic. My hero of this week, the Solari hero of this week, is my partner Chuck Gibson here. Chuck is my partner at Sea Lane Advisory, the new investment advisory company we started in the San Francisco Bay Area. Chuck is an engineer by training and absolutely ruthlessly committed to rigorous analysis to understand value. He's a skeptic in the pump part of the cycle, and he never panics in the dump part. So everything is an opportunity to Chuck if you understand what has value and are prepared to price it critically. My frustration reached a peak this week because of the growing intensity and sophistication of the lies in the financial arena. And so I've decided to schedule a Solari report next month on June 16th called Unpacking Financial Advice. And I want to talk about how to sort through financial advice that comes through the media. I'm going to take a lot of the popular commentators and sort of go through their piece and talk about how to get the good parts and leave the bad parts behind. If there are particular aspects or particular commentators that you want me to cover, please keep me posted at the card or by email, or certainly post. You can post it in the webinar software. So it was quite a week, and we have much more to sort through, because I think this summer, as I said in the wrap-up at the beginning of the year, I think this summer is going to be a crunch time, and so this is a good time to just take a deep breath, count to 10, and do not lose your cool. So with no further ado, I'm not going to do Ask Catherine. We've gotten a series of questions, and I'm going to reserve them for our conversation with Jim Norman. It's my pleasure to introduce Jim to you again. He's a veteran business journalist and energy reporter. He writes for McGraw-Hill's Platts Oilgram News. He's been a senior editor at Forbes and Business Week. He's won an AP Award for investigative reporting on oil and gas scams. He's, as I said before, he's been on the Solari Report twice last year, both to introduce the oil card to us and to cover the Gulf oil spill. His knowledge of energy markets is really extraordinary, and he can talk at the macro level or all the way down, right down to the street level into the pump. So he's somebody who can connect the dots between global markets and what it means to you and me and our assets and life on Main Street. So it's a pleasure to welcome Jim in from New York. Are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me back yet again.
Well, tell us what, I don't even know where to begin. Just introduce, because not everybody heard your first interview. Explain to them the premise of your book, The Oil Card, how you came to sort of understand what was going on in the deeper system and how you came to write the book.
Right. Well, the basic thing about this book is it looks at the, basically, it's a how to manipulate oil prices on a global macro level. Now, intuitively, people would say that's impossible. You can't do it. It's a huge fungible market. You can't do that. But in fact, if you go back and see, now there's a clear paper trail record of how the United States and its allies actually did manipulate downward the price of oil in the 1980s to bust the Soviet Union. It took a decade or more, but we were extremely successful at it. And you can go back now and see exactly the levers that were used. We leaned on the Saudis to produce more oil. We leaned on the majors to produce more oil. The NYMEX came into existence, which was characterized by a barrage of short selling, a whole bunch of stuff going on that basically depressed the price of oil as a global commodity. And it took away enough of the hard currency for the Soviet Union that they actually had to go hat in hand to borrow $100 billion to feed their people, which was the beginning of the end, because when the popular uprisings began in Eastern Europe, the strings attached to those loans prevented them from sending their armies into Eastern Europe. The Soviet Union ultimately collapsed, and the economists, the Russian economists, going back and looking at it and say, what did it in? Yep, it was that oil price. And so when I started to see oil prices take this hockey stick upward trend back, actually started in the late 90s, 98, I would say.
Can I just point one thing? Before it started back up, you notice we went in. I just was mentioning it in terms of Dave Lipton possibly ending up running the IMF. We went in at that point, encouraged the privatization of a great amount of assets, including oil. And so you had a lot of European and American players pick up equity pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
So
right,
keep going. So now that the prices go up, it's a different group of – it's a different cast of characters who now own and control the Russian oil as the price goes back up.
Mm-hmm. Right. But it's the way I look at it is the ownership issue, that's a very interesting corollary to pursue here. But the main thing I've tried to focus on is the use of macro commodity pricing as an economic weapon, actually an instrument of economic warfare. That was actually the term that was being used by the people in Reagan National Security Council. And I think they were so successful at it that it's an irresistible temptation to use it again. And this time you can see the vulnerabilities of China in terms of their exposure to having to import vast amounts of crude oil, iron ore, bauxite, copper, a whole range of metals and agriculture products that they reprocess and then sell again as exports. So if you can run up their cost of inputs sufficiently and push down the dollar enough to hurt their terms of trade, you can make life very painful for an economy like the People's Republic, which is so dependent on exports for such a large share of their GDP. The dirty little secret is that the Chinese really don't make a lot of money. They keep their people employed. They churn a lot of activity. But in terms of actual profitability of their basic industries, if you deducted the subsidies that they get and the bad loans in their banks, it's probably been a net wash for many, many years, and it's getting worse right now as we continue to drive down the dollar.
Yeah, they're getting squeezed.
I think they're severely squeezed. They're not having a good time. And at what you've seen, this book I came out with in 2008, but since then I think this economic war between the United States and China has just come out of the woodwork. They're not even pretending to hide it anymore. It's an out-and-out currency war. Chinese bid up the dollar by buying dollar-denominated debt, building up massive amounts of foreign currency reserves that they can never really spend very well. Meantime, we're out there pushing down the dollar with QE2, and it has engendered a global currency war with just about every country intervening to push their currencies downward to remain competitive in exports. So, yeah, you've seen a bit of a blip up here lately in the dollar. I don't know if it's because we want it to rise
just,
or somebody
yeah,
else is being more aggressive about it.
You know, it kind of cycles up and down on the way down.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think this is more than an interim cycle.
No, I think the trend is still very, very much with us, and it's toward higher commodity prices and a lower currency, again, aimed at trying to rein in and slow down economic growth in China, because that translates into military power as well, ultimately. If you look at the mercantilistic practices the Chinese have been pursuing, whether or not they mean it this way, certainly our national security establishment views it as a threat and is responding to it. And the thing about this economic war stuff is that you find it goes on over very long periods of time, decades really. But it can be waged with severe intensity, even though there's no actual casualties. I mean, bodies lying on the ground necessarily.
But
it can be tremendous
war.
Amounts of
yeah.
money right. employed on a global scale. So, and the pace of the activity also becomes a weapon in itself. You know, if you can control the pace of warfare, you can wear the other guy out before they can respond. And
well,
I think that
it's go ahead.
I think that's another aspect of it. I think that the rate at which we're able to control events has got to be rather tiring for the Chinese and others as well. My completely contrarian perception is that we're not the victims necessarily in this thing. I think we're the aggressors in many ways.
Oh, yeah.
And successfully
no, definitely.
So, I think.
Well, I think it's very wearing for anybody who's trying to get something done in the real economy. Because if I'm trying to grow something and ship it abroad and trade, and I'm using a financial system, whether it's the banking system or currency or, you know, all the different things, and I'm just trying to use it to do a legitimate business that the world wants done, and you're instead using the whole system for economic warfare, you know, it drives me crazy because I get hiccuped and thrown all over the place.
Yeah, you can't get a true price on anything.
Right.
That's what got me so enraged to write this book. I said, these oil prices are crazy. And this was at $50 a barrel. Before they ran up to almost $150 a barrel. Then they fell,
right.
Now they're back up to $100, and they could go to $200. I mean, there's no limit. Oh,
I think that's their goal. I think they want it at $200.
Yeah. And the way you do it is... Actually, the formula is not that hard to do. I mean, if you want to run the price up, all you need is just kind of snug up the physical market so there's not a lot of extra barrels sloshing around. And then you throw money at the futures market, which trades many, many times more paper barrels per day than the actual physical
right.
market. And that's really where the price gets set. And so if you just put enough dollars to work there, you can move the price to the moon and back if you want, which is why it's interesting to see what has happened here in the last few weeks with another round of margin increases on a whole range of commodities, including crude oil, which had a dampening effect of helping to pull the price back from, you know, the NYMEX price for crude had gotten up to like $115 a barrel. Then it came down to like $95. It's back to around $100. It's like somebody is kind of targeting, well, let's keep it around $100 for a while here. Cool things down a little. You know? It's amazing how it hovers around these arbitrary levels, you know.
When I first started to get into precious metals, having watched how they manipulated the mortgage market, I knew the capacity to manipulate was extraordinary. And then I got into the precious metals market, and I saw the extent to which, you know, you could literally control and manage a global market. Now, you know, this thing has many decades of history, so it didn't just happen overnight. And to me, part of it is, you know, when even the head of the IMF knows you have the power to do that to him, you know, people tend to toe the central line. So all of that I knew, but until I read your book, I'll never forget. You had one sentence where you described the fact, and this was a couple years ago, that ExxonMobil's finding cost per barrel was $4.
Oh, that was, and, it was $4 back in the early 80s. It has since fallen to about 40 cents. Their finding cost is less than a dollar a barrel now, to finding another barrel in the ground. the cost of finding and developing it so that you can produce it, actually getting it out of the ground, the total all-in cost for Exxon is maybe $15 a barrel.
Right. Well, think about
the stuff at $100.
Imagine if the cost of a pair of shoes, let's say the average price of a pair, I don't know, what do you guess, $100? Let's say it's $100, okay? Imagine if the markup was, you know, 85% on shoes. I mean, it's just amazing to me to think of what the markup on this stuff is.
Right. Well, but what's more amazing to me is why are these guys sitting on their hands if that's the case? And what you see, and this is one of those dog that didn't bark moments in the book. You know, if these guys can actually find oil that cheap and sell it so rich, why aren't they making hay while the sun shines? And in fact, their liquids production has been flat and falling during this period. All the major oil companies, this is at a time when the independent companies, the little guys, who, you know, are usually cash-strapped and short on technology, these guys are going gangbusters, increasing their liquids production at double-digit rates just from drilling wells in North Dakota and places where, you know, they're just relatively hard to get the oil out of the ground, but they can do it and they can increase their production with no problem. But the majors just sit there on their hands, oh, we just can't find any more oil. The point is, there's a whole bunch of ways the national security establishment can keep a lid on oil production. I mean, the Gulf oil drilling moratorium in and of itself, you know, however horrendous that spill was, and it was horrendous, still, I mean, we ought to be able to be out there drilling oil if we really wanted to get it out of the ground. But Washington has basically said no to that. And the other thing that troubles me so much from a government policy standpoint is the fact that the CFTC, which controls these futures markets, has just stood back, opened the floodgates to a torrent of managed money, pension money, public employee pension funds. Government-run, basically, pension funds have allocated astounding amounts of their portfolios to futures trading, which until a few years ago was verboten.
It was unthinkable.
It was unthinkable. I mean, now it's viewed as a no-risk asset class. You just buy the Goldman Sachs index, and, you know, it's a great hedge for whatever, and you can justify pouring huge amounts of money into it. And as a result, these futures markets have been so skewed by these huge amounts of managed funds that have come in there, all of it on the long side, overwhelmingly on the buy side of these contracts. Now, technically, that money is not classified as speculative money because it goes into the market through the swap desks at the big banks. Swap desks take the money from the pension fund. The pension fund gets what looks like an investment in an index. Then the swap desk spreads the money over the, you know, this pattern of contracts over the curve to mimic the index. But that swap desk is treated under CFTC rules as if it were a commercial player. In other words, not subject to position limits. And I don't think they're even subject to the same margin requirements as other people. So what happens is, actually, the problem is not too many speculators in a technical sense. The problem is not enough speculators. It's the speculators who we have to rely on to come into the market and bring the price back down by selling. You see, for every long, there's got to be a short.
A short. Yeah.
When there's not enough, and normally the so-called commercial players in the futures market, that would be the natural oil producers, the majors or the refiners, the people who actually deal in the physical commodities.
Right, the guys who are going long and short to do the real business, who need a hedge.
Yeah, they're the ones who are generally relied on to rationalize the price. When the price gets out of whack, then you expect the guys with real barrels at stake some way to come in and bring the price back to normal. But they've been completely overwhelmed by all of this managed money that's come in. And so what's intriguing is when the CME and the other exchanges start to jack up their margin requirements here in the last few weeks, supposedly over increased volatility, what's the net effect of that? Ultimately, I think it will be to further drive away the speculators, the little guys who are much more susceptible to margin costs than would be these big exchange-traded funds or pension investors, people like that, the managed money guys. They don't really give two hoots
about. They can't afford to deal with the volatility.
Yeah, that's true. So what? And plus, you know, we've already killed off a lot of the shorts anyway, just by letting the market run up so much. I mean, anybody who's been short through this run up has had their head handed to them. So you get into a runaway position like you did in 2008, where once these prices start on an upward geometric climb, the market just runs away from you. Doesn't even take a lot of money to push it upwards. It's a one-way street. And so I think that there's always the risk of that again. Now, is there a concerted effort to try and keep the price under control? Maybe. I mean, the IEA, the International Energy Agency in Europe, they just came out asking OPEC to pump more oil because, oh, we think there's an oil shortage going to happen. We don't want that price to run up too much now, do we? To me, though, this is just pure theater because it's just ringing these alarm bells needlessly. OPEC,
well, you're clucking to the horse while you're pulling hard on the reins and drawing them in, you know.
Yeah, I mean, OPEC would tell you the world is swimming in crude, and it is right now, frankly. I mean, we've got so much crude oil in storage all over the globe, we don't have enough barrels to store it in. You know? there's no shortage of physical crude anywhere, even with Libya off the market. You know, that's like a million barrels a day.
Here's the question. Did we go into Iraq to shut off oil? I mean, did we go in to keep the price high by shutting off the supply?
I think that was part of it. What I say in the book, and this is another contrarian thing, is that Iraq was about oil. Duh. I mean, but not in the way most people think. I mean, it wasn't that we wanted to go in and grab the oil ourselves and own it, the Dick Cheney kind of conspiracy thing. No, I think really the problem was Saddam had started to do deals with the Chinese to sell in-the-ground oil reserves to the People's Republic of China so that as soon as UN sanctions would have been lifted at the end of 2003, you would have had Chinese boots on the ground garrisoning large undeveloped or underdeveloped oil fields in Iraq. And once you had that happen, you'd never get them out of there. And that's where I think the Bush administration ran out of time. The only way to preempt that was just invade the country, take them off the market. And it did take, you know, 1.5 million or 2 million barrels a day of production off the market, which helped push the price up some more. But the main objective was to avoid Chinese ownership of in-the-ground reserves in the Middle East. And that, I think, was also a key factor in what you see going on in these Arab Spring actions. You know, in Libya, what I had been hearing is that, in fact, Gaddafi was getting ready to basically throw out all of the existing Western company oil contracts that Libya had signed and rewrite them all with even more onerous terms. I mean, he was already taking like 90 cents on every dollar that was being produced there. But it was like he was going to take yet more or maybe turn them over to the Chinese. But I think he was nervous about that because he saw what happened to Saddam. And in fact, the Chinese had actually bid to take over an oil company, a Canadian oil company, that had found a bunch of reserves in western Libya. And I think that Gaddafi was nervous about that, and so the government itself, the National Oil Company in Libya, stepped in, preempted that deal, took over the oil company. But would they eventually give it to the Chinese? I don't know. What you find is that before the bombs started dropping there, the Chinese moved a warship into the Mediterranean, the first time they'd ever deployed a combat vessel into the Mediterranean, and then began a massive evacuation of 36,000 Chinese nationals who were in Libya for
that's
whatever
quite a,
reason. It was
quite
not only
logistics.
Yeah, I mean it was multiple boatloads, cruise liners and ferries and about 100 or so charter airline flights. It was like a steady stream of buses moving people out to Egypt. I mean it was a massive evacuation effort. Because there were Chinese technicians all over Libya, not only running their oil field service industries, but also rebuilding their entire telecom network. There's another strategic hot button thing. I mean, the Chinese were getting into Libya big time. And I think it could have been just like with Saddam, Muammar was doing business with the wrong people at the wrong time in the wrong place. And, he's buying himself a lot of problems. The Syrians are in the same boat there. They've had a long and warming relationship with the Chinese. You know, the Chinese were pretending to be building a refinery on that site where the Israelis blew up that nuclear facility in Syria a year or so ago. You look at Yemen, I think there's a Chinese component to that thing. Basically, wherever the Chinese go, trouble follows. Now, maybe it's just completely coincidental. Maybe these are completely sui generis grassroots uprisings of the people who just happen to be Twittering each other at the same moment, and, oh, let's go have a riot. I don't think so. The whole thing is so well orchestrated that it's just this is another aspect of this economic warfare milieu that we're in, where there's no actual state fingerprints on things. Well, I guess there are now in Libya, where we've got NATO bombing things, but it's always under some amorphous cover story.
So, right, that increasingly just don't make any sense, so we all walk around in this state of sort of free-floating anxiety. What?
Right.
Well,
that's where I think the book is kind of useful, because it basically says if it doesn't make sense, it's probably because it's some aspect of U.S.-China economic warfare. Once you look at it that way, a lot of things kind of make more
right,
sense.
Once you realize that this is the way, it's funny because just I'm a man in the street. I'm paying, $4.30 a gallon for gasoline out here in California. But when you think about it, if the United States, let's look at the flip side, if they don't checkmate China, if they don't keep the dollar as the reserve currency, if they don't extract a global taxation through the balance sheet, what would happen? I mean, if everybody in America had to pay market price, a true market price for all the goods they buy that are produced in China, I dare say it would hit their budget much harder than, paying $4 plus for a gallon of gasoline. So if you look at the price to the consumer in the first world of keeping the oil and gas price high versus the cost of losing the subsidy of extracting whatever is extracted globally, I bet the economics work in the short run to the net favor of Main Street. Does that make any sense?
I see what you're trying to say. I wish I could do that math in my head. I really can't. It's hard to tell. I mean,
it's hard to tell.
I did. There was that video you put up on your website, that Jimmy Goldsmith interview. I went and reviewed that, and he was quite he was quite prescient. This was back in the mid-90s, I think, didn't he do that? Where he basically warned about this global free trade thing. This is the GATT agreement at the time, where basically Western developed countries lower their trade barriers on the mistaken theory that everybody will get richer. In fact, it has eviscerated many of these Western economies. Jobs have just gone, and the wealth has been transferred to places like China. And I think the theory was, oh, well, that's good because we'll make them abide by rule of law now, governed by world trade standards. Well, okay, except that the other guys want to lie, cheat, and steal. So, and the enforcement mechanisms are rather slow and creaky and ineffective. And so you've had a one-way street on trade. And I think that everybody's temper is at the boiling point over this. And the Chinese just don't have many friends out there. I mean, they've in effect raped and pillaged not just us, but all our neighbor countries as well. And the reaction is, I think, going to build more and more. And I think you're going to see gradually a collapse of these global free trade arrangements, just like happened back in the Depression.
In the 30s.
Yeah. You know, back then, people talk about that. It was that Smoot-Hawley tariffs that we enacted. That's what caused the Depression. Well, people forget that. Back in the 30s, you know, the United States really was the world's equivalent of China at that time. We had industrial capacity double what we needed internally, and we were exporting. We were the world's low-cost producer of steel and cement and just about any other kind of commodity, same way the Chinese are now. And the Europeans were the ones who said, hey, you guys are wrecking our industry. We're going to put up some tariff barriers because you're not playing fair. And it's when the Europeans did that's when we reacted with our Smoot-Hawley tariffs in reaction to that. But what happened when the Depression hit? Trade dried up. The United States suffered twice as much unemployment as Europe did. Our unemployment rates were twice as high as they were in Europe because we had so much surplus industrial capacity that just went dark, just went idle. And that's the risk the Chinese are running here, too. They have hitched their wagon to basically an obsolete 19th century industrial model and have exposed themselves to tremendous underutilization if trade starts to collapse on them. That's why I think they're extremely nervous and very vulnerable. And
their problem is they just got to keep people working.
Right.
And that's a huge political vulnerability.
Right. You see how nervous they are over these Arab Spring uprisings. You know, as soon as that happened, they started to censor all the news of that stuff. They started to clamp down on internet traffic, twittering, and all that stuff. The Chinese are apoplectic that something like that could break out in China, and they just couldn't keep the lid on it, I think. Best news for the Chinese.
Imagine how painful Tiananmen Square must have been to go through for a leader. Ugh.
Yeah, I mean, and the world reaction afterwards. They don't want to have to go there again. And so at the least whiff of social unrest like that, they get tough right away, and people just disappear and go into detention somewhere and I guess get brainwashed or re-educated or whatever. So it's brutal, just like all of these governments are when it comes to maintaining control.
I think that having lived through a similar process here.
Yeah, exactly.
We can't be calling kettles
black here.
Well, but I think we're in a situation where all governments are feeling fragile because the situation is so, it's so hard to get. It's so hard to get out of this scramble mode and find a way to cooperate because you just have so many players who won't obey any kind of set of rules. And so I just think everybody's feeling very, very fragile. And, and tempers really have risen extraordinarily. So, I sympathize. Having been in a government position, I sympathize with how fragile it can feel. Because, you're always wrong. And there's not a lot of support for helping you craft something that is reasonable all the way around.
Right. Well, that's so, why government legitimacy is a key commodity that you don't want to lose it. You know, it's amorphous, but that's why even this birther thing has got to have been a thorn in the side of a bunch of people there, because however wacky some of those criticisms are, I think that my take on that is that there is a problem, not that he wasn't born in the United States necessarily, but the real problem is that I think Mr. Obama, like various of our other recent presidents, is really a child of the whole national security establishment. His mother's resume reads like right out of the CIA employment human relations department, And his whole life was blessed. I mean, like Bill Clinton, Rhodes Scholar from Arkansas, okay, and then suddenly governor of Arkansas, and then president of the United States. I mean, these are unknown people of really.
They're beginning to look like the oil price,
Well, exactly. They're manufactured to suit the needs of the moment, almost. And, it's disheartening at best. But I guess you just get used to it and live with it and hope the guy does the best he can. But you just have this feeling we've had a continual parade of cardboard cutouts for leaders of the free world.
It's the same thing that you said about price. If you can't see an honest economic price, because the financial system is not just something we use to transact. It's something we use to communicate, because what I need to know is what's the most effective way to use my time and resources to get where it is I think I want to go. And if I'm constantly getting a false price, that's always telling me to head in the wrong direction. And so you get you get households, you get communities, you get governments, you get enterprises. Everybody starts behaving in wildly unproductive ways. Because their incentives are telling them to head in the wrong direction.
Right, and you get bubbles here and depressions there, and it's just misallocation of capital all over the place.
And it's misallocation of human capital and financial capital. And, you end up thinking, and so one of the things I struggle with, how can I aspire to be excellent when everything's upside down, It's really challenging. Well, let's get back to the Middle East. One of the things we were talking about with Colonel Wilkerson was the economics of building pipelines and long-term infrastructure, in a situation where you have these kinds of, political tensions and the danger that we end up with, just long-term military occupation to make sure, including by corporations with private armies, to make sure that everything goes the way their investment needs it to go.
Right. Well, the unrest basically precludes big pipeline investments. So, like that pipeline between the gas line between Egypt and Israel has been blown up a couple of times in the last week or so. I mean, just for fun, I suppose. what's interesting. I find it very interesting. There was in the last week or so, there's some stories finally coming out of the woodwork that the Chinese and the Russians are screaming at each other over oil. The Russians finally built this long pipeline out to the Pacific Ocean, and they allowed the Chinese to build a spur to tap into that to take a couple or 300,000 barrels a day, about enough for one refinery. That's all the Russians would sell. And the rest, the Russians want to ship it all the way out to the Pacific, put it on boats, and sell it to the Japanese. So the Russians are kind of trying to be nice to the Chinese by giving them a little bit of that oil, but not much. And now it turns out the Chinese are stiffing them on a bill because they think the Russians are charging them too much, which they are. I mean, the Russians are charging for that oil more than if the Chinese had bought the stuff in the Persian Gulf, put it on a boat, and shipped it halfway around the world. Normally, pipeline oil should come at a much lower price than waterbound crude. But the Russians have been able to extract a Persian Gulf premium for that oil, and now the Chinese are saying, no, we're not going to pay that. So that whole...
Yeah, the Chinese just launched their first aircraft carrier group. Do you know that?
They eventually will, yeah. I'm sure it's just a matter of time. I think that the Chinese military spending has been prodigious in the growth of their capabilities. I think the Chinese are definitely a military threat, if not to us, then certainly to all their lesser neighbors around there. I mean, how do you think the Filipinos feel? I mean, or the Vietnamese, even the Indonesians, and Japan. I mean, I think you're seeing a rapid militarization of Asia, and it's inexorable. That's why, as brutal as economic warfare might be, it sure beats
the
alternative.
It's not as brutal as the other one, right? Right. It's in a funny kind of way. It's a more civilized. It reflects an evolution towards a more civilized model.
Yeah, and I think that's the way things have been moving. Less bloodshed, but more brutality, in a sense. And I think we're going to just have more of the same.
One of the things I try and do on the Slayer Report, Jim, is use movies to describe different phenomena, because I find, you know, sort of it's all in the movies. And the first time that you came on the Slayer Report, the movie was Syriana, which is George Clooney's movie about sort of oil politics in the Middle East. And it's this tension in one oil producing between a group of brothers. One is supporting the U.S. and the other is wants to do a deal with the Chinese and gets taken. And it's a wonderful fictional account of the sort of the geopolitics, including of the, you know, the danger of doing deals with the Chinese. And how upset the Americans can get. Have you seen it?
You know, I gave up on movies a while back. I just started to get so infuriated with them. I just said, enough. Even the best ones.
Well, I can get infuriated, but I think, actually, I'm a big George Clooney fan, so I like
him. He's cool, yeah.
But anyway, that's too bad. Well, are there any movies that you think do a good job or documentaries of explaining the oil card? Maybe it's time for you to make a documentary.
I don't know. I have low expectations from Hollywood. I mean, that is one of the... It is the premier global propaganda machine.
Machinery.
So nothing comes out of there that isn't heavily doctored and skewed,
Well, I've never known anything to get out that the Pentagon didn't say. If the Pentagon doesn't want it to come out, in my experience, it doesn't come out.
Right.
So
I did my small part for humanity by writing this book, and I swear it's the last book I'm ever going to write because it's just too much work.
Well, tell us, before we close down, tell us how we can get a copy of the oil card.
You know,
I really do.
You know,
ever since I read that book, I feel like I understand my world. It was the piece that was missing for me, and it's made a huge difference. You know, I read the headlines, and it's all like, oh, well, yes, of course, that makes total sense, you know. So it just, everything starts to make sense instead of, you know, that Orwellian feeling gets away, it goes away. So I really want to say this again. If you haven't read The Oil Card, it's very good reading. It's easy reading. You'll never view the world the same, and you'll laugh a lot more as you read the headlines.
Right.
So tell us.
The cover art alone is worth the
That's true.
The cost. Plus, I had them printed in large type for us old people who have a hard time reading them. You can get it on Amazon. You could really help my poor impoverished publisher, though, if you called them up. It's a little outfit called
Chris Milligan.
Chris Milligan, yeah. One of the great heroes of our time.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
They've got an 800 number. It's 1-800-556-2012. Pure coincidence. It doesn't mean anything about the other one. But 1-800-556-2012. Or there's a website. If you go theoilcard.com, I think that'll get you there, and you can click on a link or something. It will never hit the bestseller list, but I think it could be around for a while as one of those cult classics, you know. And after I'm assassinated, it'll be valuable, I'm sure.
I don't think that's going to happen. That's going to happen.
I'm small potatoes, fortunately, Simon. But it's, you know, I think I would love it if people would read it and critique it. I mean, I would appreciate even negative feedback. If somebody's really got an extra grind with the idea in a book, by all means, I would love to hear it and let's talk about it. But I think that there's ideas there that definitely need to be considered, which, to my dismay, just never make it into the public debate. They're just dismissed. Oh, it's just conspiracy theory. Blah 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 blah.
I think it's been very hard for people to fathom the level of the ability to now manage and control markets. You know, it was just overwhelming to think that was possible. But given the events of the last 5 years, you know, a lot more people have come around to seeing it, understanding it. We have a couple of questions, and I'd love to ask them before we go.
Yeah.
One is it really peak? This is about peak oil. Is it really peak, or is it peak the price? I have a friend who worked in the gas and oil fields in the 1950s and says that many were capped with plenty of oil and gas and says that there is no peak oil problem.
Yeah, I'm definitely not a believer in this peak oil thing. I mean, eventually, at some point, yeah, I guess you'd reach a point of diminishing returns on certain kinds of crude. But, I mean, most of the world has never been explored or drilled for oil. I mean, even the United States, which is like Swiss cheese now with wells, there's still lots of oil being found. Our production is going up. Certainly, as the price goes up, there's more oil becomes economical. And, you know, enhanced oil recovery now could double the amount of oil that we've recovered from existing reservoirs that people have given up on. So there's no imminent danger of a shortage of physical barrels of crude oil. But it's a useful propaganda tool if you want to get the price up. What's interesting to me is that there is actually a reverse psychology employed back in the 80s when we were driving the price down. People don't remember it then, but all of the major Middle Eastern oil-producing countries came out in the late 80s, and they all kind of arbitrarily doubled the amount of proved reserves they claimed they had in the ground. At the time, it made it look like we had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of oil production. There was no reason for it to ever trade over $10 a barrel. Get used to it. And that was kind of the prevailing mentality.
Right.
But you can see how easily things can change. You know, it's but propaganda.
The media machinery is just, it's unbelievable. The propaganda machinery is...
That's the great Wurlitzer organ here of, propaganda.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, quickly, one more. If higher oil prices are being used to bring down the Chinese economy, why are we seeing an effort by the CME to raise margin requirements on oil in an effort to drive down prices? Is this just a short-term effort of the slow burn asserting itself to prevent a dollar collapse, or are we seeing the beginning stages of the China bubble beginning to unravel? Which the market is picking up on. Now, you sort of addressed this, but maybe if you could do it one more time.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very key point, very, very astute observation. You know, these margins, there's something behind this jacking up of margin requirements all of a sudden. Now, whether that is to actually bring the price down because the Chinese have caved, I guess it's possible, but I don't think that's happening yet. I just don't think so. Now, there were these talks between the Chinese in Washington. Now, maybe there was something going on there, and maybe we threw them a bone or something for something that they caved in on, and we said, okay, maybe we'll give you a break on the oil price for a while here. We'll see what we can do for you guys. And then mysteriously, the price kind of comes down to $100 a barrel, and margin requirements are jacked up. That's possible. But as I mentioned before, I think the longer-term impact of these tighter margin requirements will actually impact negatively on the...
Yeah, I think you're right.
The little guys, the speculators who have been relied on to moderate the price and bring it down a little
bit.
So you could actually be setting the stage for another leg up in the market.
Yeah, that's what I think. I also think that, you know, what happens is essentially by running the price up, you're squeezing a variety of parties. And it's never good to squeeze all the time, constantly. You want to squeeze, give them a break. Squeeze, give them a break. You know, it's kind of a harvest cycle.
You don't want them to go away mad.
Well, you don't want them to collapse.
Right.
You know, you want the slave to keep on working. So I think they kind of cycle it. And, you know, at some point, you need to back down, whether it's to consolidate and drive out the little speculators or to, you know, to give somebody a breather before you start squeezing again.
Well, you know, another party on the receiving end of this that you have to keep in mind, too, are the Russians. You know, the Russians are actually...
Can't let them get too rich.
Well, yeah, don't let them get too uppity. I mean, you remember that when prices were almost about to hit $150 a barrel, then they tanked down to 40. It was right at the time that the Russians invaded Georgia.
Right.
Now, I think there was some kind of a connection there that the Russians basically got uppity. They went off the reservation, and we hit them upside the head with a 2x4. And they withdrew from Georgia and have, you know, behaved themselves ever since, basically. I mean, there's the usual rhetoric back and forth, but ultimately, I mean, we've had our way with them in terms of missile defenses and all kind of military arrangements. Remember, we need to keep the Russians healthy to be able to stand up against the Chinese. And the way we do that is with oil prices. But if the Russians get too greedy or too crooked or too uppity, then they could be vulnerable to, you know, periodic downdrafts in the oil price to get their attention again. I think they understand that. And I think you see that in the somewhat moderated commentary out of Moscow. I think somehow that works in. I don't know how exactly, but that's another variable in the puzzle.
I just want to make sure that everybody's kids and grandkids think twice about saying that they want to grow up and become chairman of Exxon. It's not as easy as you think.
I think, yeah, those guys, you know, it was interesting that they were all dragged before Congress and pilloried over these oil prices. And it reminds me that, I put it in the book, you know, when Lee Raymond, the former CEO at Exxon, he would be dragged before Congress. And I admire him. I think he's a tough guy, smart guy, honest. The guy had balls, and he told them, you want to know why the oil price is so high? Well, it's geopolitics. That's what really determines it. Now, he didn't go into any more detail about it, but I think he delivered the message.
Yeah, because he didn't want to be accused of raping his maid.
Right. But if you look at Exxon's own behavior back in the early 80s, when we were trying to drive down the price of oil, Exxon, and to me this was an alarm bell that almost proves the point, is that when we wanted to drive down the price of oil, Exxon, against all economic wisdom, doubled the amount of wells it was drilling, ramped up its oil production by 12% in 1 year, borrowed money to drill wells, spent more than their upstream cash flow. This is so completely out of character for that company to do that. They could only have done that if they had a gun to their head, basically.
Right.
Actually, it's not a gun to the head. All it takes is a phone call. That's what one guy from the National Security Council told me. All it takes is a phone call.
Right.
And their capital spending programs get, you know, they do what they have to do. So, you know, when it comes to this, it ain't the oil companies that are running the government. The oil companies live in mortal fear of what the government can do to them. Any day of the week, any hour of the day, in
right,
a myriad of ways.
You know, my experience is behind that government is a shadow government, and so it gets very murky back there.
Right. Who is in that? And I think the oil owners certainly are a big piece of that somehow. But you know, when somebody can really unravel that, then that'll be the book to read.
Yeah.
I don't think we've gotten there yet.
I think it'll take more than one book, Jim.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this has been fabulous. You know, I can't thank you enough for, you know, for informing my worldview and coming on the Slugger Report and helping us all. So you have a wonderful evening and keep doing what you're doing. And I want you to change your mind about writing another book because I'd love another one. So you never know.
I'll think about it. Okay, well, if I do, you'll be the first place I'll come to try and test the theory. So, but thanks again for having me. This is great, and blame me for any outrageous comments tonight. If any of your listeners want to discuss anything further, please have them send me an email or forward it along, and I'm happy to carry on the debate.
Where can we email you?
Well, why don't they send it to you, and then you can send it to me?
Okay, we'll forward it on from customer service.
Okay, great.
Have a great night, Jim. And that reminds me, Darlene Heckman at customer service, remember that number, 888-755-3548. Let us know what we can do to make the Slugger Report an excellent experience for you. Coming up on June 2nd, Bertram Verhaag from Munich, the director of Scientists Under Attack, amazing new documentary on what has the pressure that's been put on scientists doing research on genetically modified food who are trying to protect us from genetically modified food. June 9th, Precious Metals Market Report. Then June 16th, as I described, Unpacking Financial Advice. Again, send me if there are things you want me to address or commentators you want me to address in that. I'd love to do it. Lots of transcripts now at your control panel. We're just going to put up next week the new Precious Metals top 10 dates with the latest one we just did with Franklin. Lots of good stuff. So I remind you again, and please feel free to use these transcripts to share with your family and friends and to use them in any way that can be useful to you. So until June 2nd, when we come back to talk with the Director of Scientists Under Attack, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.